This is a hugely significant moment for us, as the convention was opened for signature on the 10th of December 1982 in Montego Bay in Jamaica. This marked the culmination of almost a decade of work involving participation by more than 160 countries representing all regions of the world, all legal and political systems, and the spectrum of socio-economic development. The convention codified the existing practices, the norms and rules of the law of the sea, and at the same time, it introduced new legal concepts, regimes, and addressed the existing challenges at that time.
You said the convention codified existing rules. How were the oceans governed before the convention?
Before the existence of the UN, the oceans were regulated by customary international law. And of course, that is the practice of states when they act with the conviction that they do so under a legal obligation. So it's essentially the practice of states. However, from 1949 to 1956, the International Law Commission, which is a permanent body of the GA, tasked with the codification and progressive development of international law, it considered the issue and it recommended convening an international conference on the law of the sea. The conference then was indeed convened, and four different conventions and an optional protocol were adopted in 1958. That same year, 1958, the General Assembly requested the Secretary General then to convene a second UN conference on the law of the sea to consider the topics of the breadth of the territorial sea and fishery limits. This hadn't been agreed upon under the convention. So the second conference was held in 1960, but no binding instrument was adopted.
Since there were so many treaties already on the law of the sea, what triggered states to negotiate a convention?
On the 1st of November 1967, it was in fact Malta's ambassador to the UN, who was Mr. Arvid Pardo, gave a historic speech to the General Assembly, and he called for, and I'm going to quote him, an effective international regime over the seabed and the ocean floor beyond a clearly defined national jurisdiction. End of quote. Well, of course, this was considered the definitive moment which led to the call for the third UN conference on the law of the sea.
Can you tell me a bit about the third conference?
The third conference was convened in New York in 1973. For the better part of that decade, shuttling back and forth between New York and Geneva, representatives of more than 160 states, as I mentioned earlier, sat down and discussed the issues. They bargained and traded national rights and obligations in the course of the marathon negotiations, which produced the 1982 UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. It ended 9 years later, after extraordinary work by the participating states, with the adoption in Montego Bay in Jamaica on the 12th of December of the convention.
So when did the convention become law?
Well, having been adopted on the 12th of December 1982, it entered into force then on the 16th of November 1994, which was 12 months after the date of the deposit of the 60th instrument of ratification or accession by Guyana. Today, it's the globally recognized regime dealing with all matters relating to the law of the sea and oceans. Some provisions of the convention are considered customary international law, as I mentioned earlier, and therefore they're binding on the international community. To date, the convention has 162 parties and, of course, includes the European Union. This means that only 34 member states of the UN have not yet joined the convention. In March of 2012, the Secretary General has sent letters to these 34 member states calling upon them to become parties to the convention. So this issuance by the Secretary General of letters is actually underway at the moment.
So with so many states basically signing the convention, what is the importance of the convention today?
The Convention on the Law of the Sea lays down a comprehensive regime of law and order in the world's oceans and seas, which establishing rules governing all uses of the oceans and their resources. Essentially, it enshrines the notion that all problems of ocean space are closely interrelated and need to be addressed as a whole and in a comprehensive manner. It comprises 320 articles, actually, and 9 annexes, governing all aspects of ocean space, such as delimitation, marine environment, marine scientific research, economic and commercial activities, transfer of technology, and the settlement of disputes relating to ocean matters.
Based on the convention, what are the territorial rights of states?
Well, first of all, coastal states exercise their sovereignty over their territorial sea, in respect of which they have the right to establish its breadth up to a limit not to exceed 12 nautical miles. This is essentially the breadth of the territorial seas. Foreign vessels are allowed innocent passage through those waters. Coastal states have sovereign rights in a 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone, which is known as the EEZ, with respect to natural resources and certain economic activities, and they exercise jurisdiction over marine science research and environmental protection. Coastal states have sovereign rights over the continental shelf, which is a sort of separate regime, the national area of the seabed, and those rights are for the exploration and exploiting the continental shelf. The shelf can extend at least 200 nautical miles from the shore, and more in certain cases under specified circumstances. However, these rights are not unlimited and are subject to certain freedoms.
So my next question then would be, what are those freedoms?
All states enjoy the traditional freedoms of navigation, of overflight, scientific research, and fishing on the high seas. They are obliged to adopt or cooperate with other states in adopting measures to manage and conserve living resources. Additionally, all states have freedom of navigation and overflight in the EEZ, the exclusive economic zone, of other states, as well as freedom to lay submarine cables and pipelines. Also, of course, ships and aircraft of all countries are allowed transit passage through straits used for international navigation. States bordering the straits can regulate navigational and other aspects of passage.
So does the convention only benefit coastal states?
Well, landlocked and geographically disadvantaged states have the right to participate on an equitable basis in exploitation of an appropriate part of the surplus of the living resources of the EEZs of coastal states of the same region or of the same subregion. Moreover, I think it's important to point out that in 1970, the General Assembly declared the resources of the seabed beyond the limits of national jurisdiction to be the common heritage of mankind. And of course, this is a phrase which we're all very familiar with at this stage. But it wasn't until the adoption of the convention that the international community set up a system with the goal of conserving that common heritage and profiting from it at the same time.
So then, do states have obligations towards the oceans and the seas?
Yes, well, of course, under the convention lays down, first of all, the fundamental obligations of all states to protect and preserve the marine environment. But it further states and urges all states to cooperate on a global and regional basis in formulating rules and standards and otherwise in taking measures for the same purpose. In fact, there are actually 6 main sources of ocean pollution addressed in the convention, which include land-based and coastal activities, continental shelf drilling, potential seabed mining, ocean dumping, vessel source pollution, and pollution from or through the atmosphere. States are bound to prevent and control marine pollution and are responsible for damage caused by violation of their international obligations to combat such pollution. Also, states are bound to promote the development and transfer of marine technology on fair and reasonable terms and conditions with proper regard for all legitimate interests.
Madam Undersecretary General, in your view, and as you reflect on the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea after 30 years, has it been a success in your opinion?
Well, the convention is definitively, in my view, holding out the promise of an orderly and equitable regime or system to govern all uses of the sea. But it's a club that one must join in order to fully share in the benefits. The convention, which is like other treaties, creates rights only for those who become parties to it and thereby accept its obligations, except for the provisions which apply to all states because they're either merely confirm existing customary norms or because they are becoming customary law. However, as the preamble of the convention states, the convention starts from the premise that the problems of ocean space are closely interrelated and need to be considered as a whole. So to answer your question, in sum, I would suggest that the convention has been an extraordinary success for mankind and for our interest in preserving the welfare of our oceans and our seas.